This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Our first guest, Joaquin Phoenix, stars in the new movie Her, which has earned an Oscar nomination for Best Picture. He received Oscar nominations for his performances in The Master, Walk the Line, and Gladiator. Joaquin Phoenix started his career in 1982, when he was about 8, on an episode of the TV series Seven Brides for Seven Brothers. His brother, the late River Phoenix, was a regular in the series. Joaquin Phoenix doesn't give many interviews, but he gave an infamous one on the David Letterman show in 2009, in which he barely spoke but managed to say he was giving up acting for a career in hip-hop. That turned out to be a put-on for his mockumentary I'm Still Here, which he made with his brother-in-law, Casey Affleck. Terry spoke with Phoenix last Tuesday and began with a clip from Her, in which Phoenix plays a man who's heartbroken because his wife recently left him. The hole in his life is soon filled by Samantha, the voice of his new computer operating system. The film takes place in the near future, where we meet the first OS with artificial intelligence, designed to respond to your needs and personality as it gets to know you. As they, quote, get to know each other, Phoenix's character falls in love with her, but keeps it a secret from his friends, until one of his friends, played by Amy Adams, confesses she's become good friends with an operating system.
That's weird, right? That I'm bonding with an OS. No, it's okay. It's weird.
Well, I don't think so. Actually, the woman that I've been seeing, Samantha, I didn't tell you, but she's an OS.
You're dating an OS? What is that like?
It's great, actually.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel really close to her. Like, when I talk to her, I feel like she's with me.
Are you falling in love with her?
Does that make me a freak?
No. No, I think anybody who falls in love is a freak.
Joaquin Phoenix, welcome to Fresh Air. It's really great to have you on the show.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thanks, Terry.
So for this role, which is, you know, the film sets at some point in the near future, you have a mustache, glasses, you're wearing a lot of, like, orange, your pants are very high-waisted. Did you have any involvement in creating the character's look?
I think always, you know, everyone kind of goes in. I think everyone has their ideas, and you slowly start kind of sifting through it until you land on stuff that feels right. I think the thing that I love so much about making movies is the collaboration. And, you know, I've told the story before, but, you know, Casey Storm, the wardrobe designer, he's the one that picked the glasses. And, you know, we had a box of 100 glasses, and, you know, he grabbed a pair, and we tried on a few others, but it's the one that seemed right. So I think everyone kind of goes in, and you have your ideas, and you start working together, and it just slowly unfolds.
So, you know, in some ways, your female lead, your romantic interest in this is a voice. It's the voice of the operating system. And, you know, it's been reported, so a lot of people know this, that Samantha Morton was originally cast as that voice, and then she was replaced with Scarlett Johansson. So did you record all of your lines twice, once with Samantha Morton and then again with Scarlett Johansson?
No, not quite like that. I actually worked with Samantha Morton. She was with us on set oftentimes, and I worked with her, and then I went in the studio, and I worked with Scarlett later. But I imagine, although I haven't talked to Spike, but I imagine the majority of the dialogue that was already recorded on my end probably stayed, but I'm not sure what they used.
So you mean even if you did it twice, it might have been the first version that you used?
Yeah.
What was the difference for you as an actor between their two performances?
Really, I worked with Samantha. You know, she was on set, and so we really developed our characters together in a way. And with Scarlett, I worked with her just in the studio, and so it was just completely different experiences. You know, I had such an amazing time working with Samantha Morton, and feel so beholden to her for helping me develop this character. And then I worked with Scarlett, and she was incredible too. And I found something new about the relationship, and we had new discoveries, and it was an extraordinary process. And I just I feel really lucky because I just got to work with these two great actors.
Do you use audio programs like Siri?
You know, it's funny. We were coming here. We were late, and my publicist Sue was driving. By the way, if she ever offers you a ride, don't take it. but she was driving, and we were lost. And she started using the navigation, Now, the thing is, it's amazing how you project onto these devices, because I was certain that the voice, when she was saying turn left, that she was anxious. And she was like, you're late and you've got to turn left. It suddenly sounded as if she was very anxious. Now, I know that's not the case, but it sounded that way.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Joaquin Phoenix, and he stars in the new movie, Her. So I want to talk about, if it's okay with you, I'd like to talk about other films that you've made and talk a little bit about your life. You starred in the film The Master with Philip Seymour Hoffman. And I just think that's such a brilliant film. And in The Master, you play a World War II veteran who's psychologically and physically damaged by the war, though you might have been psychologically and physically damaged even before that.
Yeah, Paul always said, I said, is the damage because of the war? He said, I don't think it helped.
Yeah. You meet up with this cult, you accidentally meet up with this cult leader, played by Philip Seymour Hoffman, who becomes like a father figure to you. And he sees himself as this kind of prophet who can put people in touch with their higher selves and also put them in touch with their past lives. And he has all of these exercises to help accomplish that. So he puts you through one of these exercises, and it's called processing. And it's he gives you a series of rapid-fire questions that you're supposed to answer. And the first time he does it, it doesn't go that well. The second time, he insists that you not blink. And I want to play...
sounds like every interview I've ever done, Terry. Okay.
You're not blinking, right? And so I want to play that scene. So here's my guest, Joaquin Phoenix, being questioned by a cult leader played by Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Starting now, you're not to blink. If you blink, we go back to the start. Infringement. You blinked. Starting now, you're not to blink. If you blink, we go back to the start. Do you often think about how inconsequential you are?
No.
Do you believe that God will save you from your own ridiculousness?
No.
Have you ever had intercourse with someone inside your family?
Yes.
Have you ever had intercourse with someone inside your family?
Yes.
Who?
My auntie.
Have you killed anyone?
No.
Maybe?
Not me.
Have you killed anyone?
No.
How many times did you have intercourse with your aunt?
3 times.
Where's your aunt now?
I don't know.
Would you like to have intercourse with her again?
No.
Do you regret this?
No.
Where's your mother?
I don't know, Looney.
Infringement. Back to the start.
Okay.
Such a great scene. It's my guest, Joaquin Phoenix with Philip Seymour Hoffman in a film from The Master. My questions are nothing compared to those questions. So tell us a little bit what you did to get into Freddie's mind. Freddie's mind is such a strange place to be.
Yeah, it was so strange because with Freddie, it was like whenever you would think that you figured something out, then it suddenly would fall apart. Like it was one of those characters where the more questions I had, the more uncertain I was about things, the better it was. It was just this ongoing process. I mean, there's a lot of character thing where you try and really you get to a solid place with them. You have a certain understanding. Freddie, it seemed like the less I understood, less I understood, because I don't think that he understood. I don't think
he had no self awareness at all.
Him.
Absolutely
no. And so it was interesting. It was very frustrating in the beginning because I couldn't really get a straight answer. And then I think that when I just stopped worrying about the answer, I started finding it.
Well, I think.
And I think you nailed it.
One of the things I love so much about your performance is what you did with your body. You talk out of the side of your mouth, and it slurs your speech. And you look almost as if you'd had a small stroke that affected one side of your face. Can you talk about deciding to play it that way?
Yeah. My dad sometimes would talk out of the side. He'd clench down one side of his mouth. And I thought it just represented tension in this way. Somebody that's blocked and tight. So I actually went to my dentist. And I had them fasten these metal brackets to my teeth, and then I on the top and the bottom, and then I wrapped rubber bands around it to force my jaw shut on one side. And you know, as this is about, this is in the beginning before we started shooting, and after a couple of weeks, the bands, they just weren't, they weren't really strong enough to kind of hold it. And so I ended up just getting rid of the rubber bands, and I still had these metal brackets in, so it made me constantly aware of my cheek, you know, and they had these pointy tips, so they'd tear up the cheek a little bit. So I just then was just constantly aware of it, and then was able to just kind of keep it shut on my own. This is so stupid. Why am I talking about this?
Because I asked, and because it's interesting.
It's not interesting.
It
it's
is interesting.
So no. If I was driving and I heard this, I'd change the channel.
I wouldn't.
I'd be like, well, I can shut up.
Really? Does it bother you like that?
No, I mean, I don't know. Sometimes I just, think it's like, who cares?
We who love movies care. Does that help answer the question?
Okay.
So there's another scene I have to, you know, I love this film so much, and I love your performance in it, so forgive my curiosity, but one of my favorite scenes in the film is you and Philip Seymour Hoffman, the cult leader who's become like a father figure to you, you're both arrested and you're put in adjoining jail cells. And he's all about control. You know, he's all about controlling people and controlling everything, and it's always all about him. And you're kind of uncontrollable because you're kind of like an animal in a lot of ways who can't be house trained. Like, and the way you're walking around in the cell, your posture is somewhere almost between like a monkey and a chicken. You know, like you're bent over, your head and neck is forward. And you're so angry and you're so frustrated and so kind of pent up and claustrophobic, you just start kicking at the toilet, at the porcelain toilet in your cell. And you kick it so hard, it shatters.
And it was a very old toilet, and I think those things degrade.
No, exactly, because where you shot was a former prison that was now like a prison museum, and it's like an antique toilet. Like, when you realize that you'd like smashed this like antique toilet in like the prison museum, you just kept going, and so did Philip Seymour Hoffman. He doesn't even blink. He just keeps going and goes on with his lines. And was there a part of you that wanted to go, oh my God, I just broke this toilet, now what?
You know? I don't remember. I don't think so. I don't think I was thinking about the toilet.
Because you were so in character?
I don't know if I'm so in character, but just because you're working. I mean, I think at that point, it was obviously an important scene, and it's something that we'd been talking about for months, and the scheduling of it had kept changing, I think, based on the location and what was available. And so, you know, when we got there, it was Phil's last day. And I think what's important is that you try to get into the right mental state. And so I think that's all that you're thinking about, you know, at least for me. So I think that probably when we're finished with the take, I think the only thing I thought of is what do you want me to do differently, Paul? What do you want to do? What, you know? So I remember it afterwards, it was a thing, and they said it was this antique, equipment that was broken. It was a mistake. I'm sorry. I apologize to everyone involved.
Have you ever slept with a member of your family? No.
No, I haven't. But I did blink.
You did blink. Okay.
Yes. Actually, I've been blinking a lot. I've just been, my publicist, I can see through the glass, and I've just been mouthing to her, I'll kill you and never again, and giving her the bird. So I haven't been keeping my eyes from blinking.
So apparently in that movie you stayed in character in between scenes.
Oh, come on, please. I don't even know what that is.
Well, I'll tell you what I interpreted that as being, that you kept the posture, that you kept the affect of the character, as opposed to just like relaxing and being, you know, totally yourself.
I'll just say this, that you just do what you're supposed to do. I'm fulfilling my obligations as an actor.
Okay. Obviously, that's making you uncomfortable, so I will move on.
I'm just saying, no, it's just because I think that sometimes we make a big deal out of it, and I think that it's just what you're supposed to do as an actor. You're supposed to do your work, and that's what I felt was required of me for that particular job.
Mm-hmm. I always think it must be odd, you know, complicated if, like, one actor is kind of staying in character and another actor isn't, and you're kind of, maybe you're alone in your trailer. I don't know. In my fantasy, like, you're together in a room and one person's in character and another isn't, and so there's this kind of mismatch.
I think on that, I did spend a lot of time alone. Oftentimes you do go back to your trailer and you're alone, but I think everyone always has their own process, and every process is valuable. There are sometimes you come in and, you know, you're telling jokes in the morning, you're talking with the crew, and then you go do a scene, and everything is useful. And it's just finding what works for you for that particular job. So, you know, I imagine it's tough for a director working with a few different actors that all have different processes, even when it's not that extreme. Just sometimes people have different needs. But, you know, as an actor, or maybe as a selfish actor like me, I've never really considered too much other people's processes. I think you just kind of try and do what works best for you in the film, the character.
Can I ask you about the mockumentary, fake documentary that you made with Casey Affleck? Right. So
mockumentary.
So here's how I first found out that something was going on, which is, I guess, the way a lot of people did. When you made that appearance on David Letterman as, you know, as yourself and coming on, but saying that you were giving up acting and you wanted to go into hip hop instead, and you hardly said a word during this. You were so uncommunicative, and Letterman was kind of at his wit's end. He was very funny, but he said it's like interviewing the Unabomber at one point or something along those lines. You had like really long, scraggly hair and a really long beard, and you were wearing sunglasses.
That's exactly how I look right now.
Is it?
No.
So
you know what? Sorry.
Oh, no, you're going to
say had a specific question.
Oh, yes. So people who saw that before they even knew that there was a documentary, because you were making it at the time, or a mockumentary, people thought, like, did you see Joaquin Phoenix on Letterman? God, he's gotten so weird. Like, what's happened to him? So what was it like for you before people had any idea what this was really about to have all these people thinking that you'd kind of gone off the deep end?
I'm not sure that I thought about that much. I mean, the only thing that bothered me was that it might be difficult for me to work again, because obviously I wasn't retiring, and obviously I wanted to continue to make films and certain kind of films. So the only thing that really gave me pause was at some point, wow, will this really affect my career? But, so much of the way that we made the movie didn't allow us the time to really consider things. And by the time we did, it was too late. And we'd painted ourselves into this corner. And it's funny, because when I was going on Letterman, initially the idea was, you know, we're going to make some noise and do something much more extroverted and kind of big and out there and possibly even, going around the stage. We weren't quite sure. And because we were trying to imagine, at this point, we still hadn't, Diddy hadn't agreed to be in the film, and that's who we wanted to be the producer that I went after that told me no. And so we were just kind of hoping that the way things were going to play out was that we were going to get Diddy, and we were going to play music, and we knew that he would say, this is no good, and you're not ready to do this. And then I would have said that I canceled David Letterman, and then I would try to get the show back and save my career. Right, so that was kind of the idea, but we didn't know that we had Diddy. We didn't know we had all these other pieces. And so just before I go on, Casey's like, listen, I think you got to play this broken. I think the best way to put this together is that you will have gone and seen Diddy, and he will say that your music's not working out, or whomever we ultimately get. If Diddy says no, we'll have to find someone else, but whoever it is. And then this is just heartbreak. This is just walking out there and knowing that you failed the thing you want to do, and so you're just virtually catatonic. And so it was just this kind of like switch 180 degrees from what we initially kind of talked about doing. And so it was really literally like when I was at the door. And so it was. It never really allowed us the time because of the process and how so much just, you know, we didn't get multiple takes oftentimes. So I think, like, if I'd had the time maybe to think about it more, it might have changed my opinion.
Well, the premise of this documentary is that you're tired of acting and you're going to go into hip hop because you're you're tired of the character of Joaquin Phoenix, and your output has been fraudulent.
It is a boring character.
Yeah, for the first time, you're going to do something that really represents you. And I'm going to play another short clip from the documentary in which you're talking about, you know, why you don't want to act anymore.
I love those rare, pure moments in between action and cut, but everything else was misery to me. We talk about it being this creative expression, and really, you're just a puppet. You're this dumb doll that wears what someone else tells you to wear, stands where someone else tells you to stand, says what somebody else tells you to say. That's not expression. That's not creativity. And I have more to offer than that. My purpose on this earth is not to interpret somebody else's words or to try and capture a moment for somebody else. It's to bring what is inside me out.
No, it's funny. It's so much of it is interpreting somebody else's words, like Casey's words.
Oh, that's so funny. Casey Affleck, who is your collaborator on the film and also your old friend and brother-in-law. That's really so funny.
I mean, he was really more the boss. Collaborator, maybe. He's more the boss.
Oh, that's hysterical. So he was like almost feeding you those lines about your authentic self.
Yeah, there's so much. I mean, I don't think people realize. I don't think people really give Casey the credit in some ways. But yeah, there's a good deal of that was scripted. So my favorite parts is a part with Edward James Olmos where he gives this amazing speech, and you know, something that Casey wrote. So it's funny. That I was saying that, and it was just based on stuff that, you know, I mean, Casey and I both did it together, but still so many of those ideas and thoughts were him, and so it's just, it's funny to hear.
Is there ever a part of you that feels like an actor is like a dog who's told, like, where to stand and what to wear? And...
No, not in that way. I do consider myself an employee, you know, I work for someone else, I consider the director to be in charge, and I'm there to help them achieve their vision. But I don't think that, I don't see that as a bad thing.
At the beginning of the documentary we've been talking about, where you're playing a version of yourself who wants to stop acting and go into hip-hop.
Documentary.
Yeah, so at the very beginning of it, there's some real footage of you and your siblings as children performing, like singing, singing and dancing. You were acting starting from when you were how old, or around six?
The first job I did, I was eight.
So was that your idea or your mother's idea to actually try to get roles?
Why you put it just on my mom's?
It was your mom's, did you say?
Why you just put it on my mom's?
Oh, I asked if it was you or her.
I'm just with you, Terry. No, it was... I mean, if you're asking if my parents were pushy stage parents, no, they're the opposite. In fact, you know, I mean, they're the opposite of that. I mean, there are often times where, you know, it must be really hard for a parent when your kid's like, I want to do this, and you go, you're probably going to get your ass kicked. And no parent wants to say, you know, keep doing it. But I think that we were just really strong-willed. I think we just knew... that we were going to act or something like that in some way. I'm not quite sure how, but you know, I know that we something that we pestered our parents about, and it happened kind of naturally. You know, my mom worked at NBC. She worked for this casting director, and of course we would visit her sometimes. And he's this really amazing, beautiful man, Joel Thurman. I owe so much to. And he, I think he was one of the first that was like, you know, these kids are they seem like they've got a lot and they're talented, and you know, considered getting them an agent. And that's really how it happened. You know, we didn't kind of come out trying to do that. It just was kind of a natural evolution.
Were the adults on the set, the directors and the actors, were they nice and generous and kind to you, or did you ever end up in tears because somebody was kind of thoughtless in the way they handled a criticism?
So I didn't understand. What was that?
Oh.
I was too busy giving my publicist the finger, so I could, I'm sorry. tell me again. tell me again.
when you were on the set as a child, yeah. were the adults, the actors, the directors nice and generous and kind, or did they sometimes holler at you and make you cry?
Oh, because, come on. This kid, who's mean to kids? No, when you're a kid on a set, you're like royalty. You know what I mean? Like, it's the best in the world. Everyone's like, oh, do you want some snacks? Do you want something? And again, like, not to make a big deal of it, but we were really broke. And so sets were like, holy, I got all this stuff. We have this amazing food, and there's all these people here, and everyone seems really happy. And it's a set that there's really nothing like being on a movie set or a TV set. It's just an incredible energy. It's so exciting. So obviously, as a kid, you're like, oh, I could go to school or I could be hanging out with these people. And, it's so interesting because there's so many different kinds of people that are on film sets. The first show I ever did was a small guest starring spot I did with my sister on a show that my brother was starring in called Seven Brides or Seven Brothers. And, they needed a young girl and boy for a guest starring spot. And I think it was probably just easy to cast us since we were already there. So I don't think we were very good, but they cast us maybe just out of necessity. That's basically been my career ever since. But it was just like, it's so funny because it was just a natural progression. It's interesting because I was 8 years old and I distinctly recall the feeling in my body once we'd shot this scene, and it was so exciting. I remember just feeling like I was buzzing, like my whole body was vibrating because it was just so exciting to have experienced this thing that wasn't real, but at moments felt like it was real. And, it's just basically the feeling I've been chasing ever since.
So do you watch a lot of movies now? And do you watch your own films?
I have. For a long time I didn't. I thought I would improve if I didn't watch them, but that didn't happen, so I started watching them again. It's funny because I hadn't watched for a long time, and Paul really got me to watch
Paul Thomas Anderson,
the Master. Yeah, uh-huh. Paul Thomas Anderson. And so I have. I've seen them since then.
And how does it feel to see yourself?
It's so much fun. honestly, it's tough because I think that, it's why I stopped watching in the first place, is that you just see your mistakes. But I think where that used to be crushing, I think now I try to just go, okay, well, but here's what you could do to prevent that from happening in the future.
So, Joaquin Phoenix, we're about to wrap up. But before we do, I want you to promise me that you're not going to fire your publicist for having set up this interview.
No, I won't. But I will make you another promise.
Okay.
I promise never to ever make you go through this again.
That's not the promise
really,
I was looking for.
Because you're too good and you don't deserve this. You deserve somebody who really enjoys talking about themselves.
But I had a great time talking with you.
No, I had a great time too. And I'll talk to you anytime. I just don't know I'm going to come on to your show again. But I'd be happy to talk to you on the phone because I really am a fan of yours. I really enjoy this program.
Oh, gee, thank you, because I'm a big fan of yours, so thank you so much.
Why, did you think I was lying when I told you that earlier?
I'll be honest with you. Some people say they like the show, and you realize what they like is just like NPR in general, and they've really never heard the show, so I always take it with a grain of salt.
Oh, well, that is what I meant. yeah, cool.
Joaquin Phoenix, thank you so much.
Okay, but also, just call me Joaquin. Don't do Joaquin Phoenix. You can just call me Joaquin.
Joaquin? Thank you so much.
Terry, I don't know your last name. Thank you very much.
Joaquin Phoenix spoke with Terry Gross last Tuesday. He stars in the new film Her, directed by Spike Jonze. To hear the full interview, visit our website, freshair.npr.org. Coming up, we discuss self-help culture with author Jessica Lam Shapiro. Her new book is called Promise Land. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Our next guest, Jessica Lam Shapiro, is the author of the new book, Promise Land, My Journey Through America's Self-Help Culture. Her father's a child psychologist who's written about 40 self-help books, and she grew up surrounded by that language and culture. But she'd actually recoiled from self-help her entire life until deciding she wanted to know, quote, why people liked self-help so much, what it meant to them, whether it worked, and if it didn't work, why people still craved it, unquote. Her new book is funny and observant and takes an emotional turn when she starts writing about a tragedy in her own family. She spoke with Terry last Wednesday.
Jessica Lam Shapiro, welcome to Fresh Air. I'd like to start with a short reading from your book, Promised Land, with you doing that short reading, not me. So this is just a short take of yours on self-help.
Yeah. This is from the very beginning. Self-help is so simultaneously debunked, adored, and ignored that it's possible to assign any meaning to it you desire. If you hate self-help, it is an exercise in futility that robs fools of their money and dignity. If you love self-help, it is a structure for self-betterment, an opportunity for enlightenment.
Where do you fit in?
Oh, gosh. Somewhere in the middle. I think when I started the book, I was more to the hating self-help and thinking it was an exercise in futility. I think I forced myself to try to be more open-minded as I worked on the book, and I came to see how it could be an opportunity for self-betterment and even for enlightenment.
So how did you decide that you actually wanted to write a book about self-help?
It came about completely by accident, and maybe it's an illustration of the ways that your unconscious can sort of lead you towards things that you need to talk about. My dad told me one day that he was going to a conference for self-help writers. And the whole idea of this just sounded very strange to me. It's going to be 600 people in Atlanta who all wanted to write self-help books. And it was being taught by a very famous self-help author who had been very successful in a way that my dad never had been. He had published books and he had self-published books, but he had never reached that mass market appeal that some of the names that you've heard of, people have TV shows, you know, he never reached that level. So I think he thought that maybe there was something, some secret to success that he didn't have that he could gain from going to this weekend conference. And it was only a weekend, so, you know, no big deal either way. So he asked me if I wanted to go. And, you know, when I was a kid, my dad and I used to do stuff like this together. So it in no way seemed strange. When I got there, I realized how strange it was. It was a huge conference. And within 2 hours, people were crying. They were doing really strange things like drawing smiley faces on each other's index fingers and saying, I see that's you. There was a real revival, religious quality to it. And I think that seeing that emotion at this conference was sort of what led me to write an article about it. And then from the article came the book.
You wanted to understand why this was happening?
Yeah, I just found it so strange.
So what's some of the advice that the famous self-help author was giving to the self-help authors and would-be self-authors who had paid to attend the seminar? The kind of advice that was moving them to tears?
A lot of it was just inspirational stories. He told the story of how he had come to be a self-help author. And the classic narrative of an inspirational story is that somebody starts from a very low place. You know, they've lost their job, they have no friends, everybody they knew has died. I mean, sometimes it's really that extreme. And then they have an idea and they put in some hard work and then they achieve an amazing goal. And I think that in a way, we're really hardwired to respond to that kind of story. We just project ourselves into that situation and it just immediately makes you feel hopeful about your own potential and your own situation. So I think that just by telling us the story of his success, everybody got really excited about the idea that they could replicate that success. And then he told us a bunch of other stories, like the story of how Rocky was made. He told us that Sylvester Stallone wrote Rocky in 3 days. He told us that it was turned down by every major Hollywood producer. He told us that someone wanted to cast Robert Redford as Rocky, which just shocked people. Everybody was like, no. Really, people were so horrified by that idea that he sold it for no money on the condition that he could play the lead. And then he said, like literally at the end of the story, did you know that David fought Goliath with only one stone? So he literally went from one inspirational story to another one that we're all familiar with. And people just got, they were just getting so excited and so pumped up by hearing, you know, oh my God, it's Rocky, it's Sylvester Stallone, but like he started out with nothing and it could have gone so wrong. And I think this kind of thing just really made people feel very hopeful about what they could achieve.
So this gets to exactly what one of the things that makes me uncomfortable about self-help. It takes the person who is the exception that proves the rule and makes the exception that proves the rule the rule. In other words, like this person had an exceptional experience. They wrote something with no experience. Everybody turned them down, and then they had this huge success, which means that you can do that too. But the point is, what makes that story exceptional is that very few people who get turned down finally get accepted like that. You know, it's not the typical story. It's unlikely it's going to happen to you.
No, that's definitely true. It's just illogical that everybody can achieve greatness. That's the whole idea of greatness is that it's not achieved by many people. And yet these inspirational stories just encourage us to think, well, I might be that exception. And I think in some ways we do all feel that we're the exception. You know, we live life completely subjectively through our own experience, and we all feel that we're unique and special. That just appeals to that wish that we have to be unique and extremely successful.
And I want to point out something else that bothers me about a certain type of self-help book or self-help approach. And you mentioned in the book that the leader of this self-help seminar for self-help writers said, don't be a tire kicker. If you're a tire kicker, you won't get anything out of this. And my problem with that is, like a lot of self-help books tell you, don't be skeptical about the advice I'm giving you, because that skepticism is going to stand in the way of you accomplishing what you want to do. But you're reading some of these books and you're just filled with skepticism, and you know, and turning it off means approach this uncritically. And why would you approach anything uncritically like that?
I completely agree with you.
Yeah.
I mean, that is a huge problem that I have with it. And if you think about it, it's really genius, because it's basically blaming you if it doesn't work.
Exactly.
It's not saying, exactly. You know, if this doesn't work, I guess I had a bad idea. It's saying, no, if this doesn't work, you didn't try hard enough. So in a sense, it becomes a completely closed system. And so in a weird way, I respect its evil genius, but I don't think it's particularly fair or thoughtful. And I definitely prefer self-help books or any books that are sort of more of an open system that allow for criticism, allow for critique, and allow for other points of view to exist.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about self-help and what is good about it and what's really annoying about it. My guest is Jessica Lam Shapiro. She's the author of the new book, Promise Land, My Journey Through America's Self-Help Culture. And her father is a child psychologist who's written a lot of self-help books, although they never reach the kind of fame that some self-help books and self-help authors reach. So for this book, she went to various self-help seminars, read like the history of the self-help genre. And so let's talk a little bit about the history of the self-help genre. What are some of the classics that you went back and read that you actually found pretty interesting?
Well, I have to say the history of the self-help genre is the thing that really made me feel like it was worth writing about. I just found it so fascinating. And just the fact that, I mean, I basically was able to trace it back to ancient Egypt. And so I thought, this is something that's been with us for so long. Like, it must be important.
What was the ancient, like, you too can become a pharaoh?
Actually, it wasn't called that, but that was the message, because it was a pharaoh that had written this book of advice for
really?
His son. Yeah, so basically he was saying to his son, you too can become a pharaoh. And then other people read it. I suppose maybe they also wanted to be a pharaoh. So, yeah, amazingly accurate guess. There were some ancient Greek texts, the Stoic philosophers, Seneca, Marcus Aurelius wrote a book called Meditations, which actually, I mean, it's a book of philosophy, but it's sold in the self-help section. And Stoic philosophy, if you're not familiar with it, it really reminded me of Don't Sweat the Small Stuff. You know, Marcus Aurelius has this really poetic language, but his message is more or less don't sweat the small stuff. Whereas the Richard Carlson book, Don't Sweat the Small Stuff, which was a huge bestseller, you know, in a sense has the same message, but it just doesn't sound as good. It sounds kind of silly. It sounds kind of offhand. But I really loved Marcus Aurelius's book, because his basic point was, we're all going to die. And that was kind of his answer to everything. So are you having a fight with your neighbor? Doesn't matter. We're all going to die. You know, did you lose your job? Doesn't really matter. Your boss is going to die and you're going to die. We're all going to die. That was kind of, I was thinking, God, this is so depressing. But, you know, in a way, it was also, did make me feel better and does kind of put things in this perspective of, like, life is much bigger and it goes on. And, you know, don't worry about having a fight with your neighbor.
Well, no, I understand exactly what you're saying. I mean, there is something strangely liberating about thinking that life is brief. It ends. You're just, you know, a speck.
Right, exactly. Don't sweat the small stuff.
Don't sweat the small stuff, right. So we've been talking about self-help, and you entered this very skeptical of self-help, even though your father is a self-help author, among other things. But at some point you realized that there was something in your life that really needed addressing, and that is that, you know, your mother died when you were about to turn two. She was born in 1948, died in 1979, and you never really knew exactly what happened, and your father always seemed very reluctant to talk about it. At first, you thought that she died in a car accident, and then as you got older, you realized that it was suicide and that she jumped off a bridge. But then, maybe it was while you were writing this book, that you learned...
No, it was before.
It was before that, that you learned how she really died. I'd like you to tell what you learned about how she died and tell us the impact that that information had on you.
I later learned that she had jumped off more of an overpass into a park. The difference for me being something about the water, just that the body would disappear and, you know, with hard ground that just seemed so much more violent. And that was very upsetting for me to hear. But it was also just upsetting to think that I had pictured it wrong for so many years. I mean, it was maybe 15 years that I was sort of in my mind picturing her jumping off a bridge, you know, like the Golden Gate Bridge or something. And it's not like I thought about it often, but when I did think about it, that's how I thought about it. And then I got this new information that that's not actually the specific way it happened. And so I think it was the fact of it was upsetting, that the image was very upsetting. But also the fact that I hadn't known, it just made me feel like I still didn't understand this thing. You know, not that it's completely understandable anyway, but it was just really disturbing to me to have envisioned it one way and then to find out 10, 15 years later that I had envisioned it completely wrong.
One of the fears that you had was, since your mother committed suicide in her early 30s, that you might too. And you actually read a self-help book that you found really helpful. And I want you to tell us about that book and why, how it helped you.
If I could try to explain the fear first, because it was so strange. I
sure,
mean, maybe it was
yeah.
because there was so much about suicide itself that I didn't understand, that it seemed to be this world of crazy logic. And that made sort of anything possible. So I had this fear that something might happen to me when I was around the age my mother had been when she killed herself that would cause me to do the same thing. You know, by accounts that I had heard, she was not a depressive person, and it had kind of come on suddenly after a car accident. And so I just thought, you know, what if that happens to me? And in fact, I did get hit by a car, and her sister called me and said, you know, well, we wanted to make sure you were okay because, you know, your mother killed herself after her car accident. And I just, like, almost hung up on her because I was so frightened. You know, it just really scared me. And I think she was well-meaning, but that was maybe not the right thing to say to somebody who just had a head injury. And, you know, it wasn't something that I thought about a lot, but it just was this kind of feeling I had, and it just felt like a premonition. And when I read this book, there was information in it that told me that 90% of women whose mothers kill themselves have the same fear that they will somehow just be led to kill themselves. And as soon as I read that, I felt better. I mean, just knowing that, I thought 90%, that's like almost everybody. You know, like that just made me feel like it was a normal thought to have. And if it was a normal thought to have, then it wasn't a premonition. And then it just completely went away. And so that was a way in which I found that self-help books, just through giving information, could be so valuable because, you know, again, it wasn't something that I spent all my time thinking about. I thought about it pretty rarely. But, you know, it was a little bit of a death sentence hanging over my head, in a sense. And to have that fear alleviated was a great feeling. And just the fact that it happened so quickly with that information, I found pretty amazing.
So this book was really helpful. At the same time, you were really turned off by the book jacket copy. and I want to read a line from that, which you quote in the book, that the book is a courageous journey into the heart of a woman's most profoundly life-altering passage. And I have this problem, too, that like when writing turns a really kind of serious, complex thought or feeling into something that sounds like a real cliché.
Drives me crazy.
Yeah, because you feel like, no, this thought really means something. This thought matters. But once you package it into the cliché, it's like it takes all of the meaning, all the life, all the complexity out of it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, the cover kind of had that sort of wistful, soft focus, mother-daughter picture, and I hated everything about that book. In fact, I had it for about 3 months before I would even open it. So it was pretty funny to me later on that it did end up being helpful to me.
Now, so now I'm going to do something really horrible.
Okay,
you ready? Okay.
Okay.
Don't take this the wrong way. I'm going to quote a line from your book jacket. Okay. This is really horrible. I'm sorry.
I did not write that copy.
I know. I figured you didn't. This is not how you write, but
do it.
With all due respect to the person who wrote your book jacket copy, okay? Promised Land is a tender, witty, and wise account of a young woman's journey through her own psyche toward the most difficult stage of grown-up emotional life, acceptance.
Oh, my God.
I know.
It kills me. It really does.
Had you read it? I mean, did you have that reaction when you read it yourself?
I did. Part of me understands that there's a fair amount of the book that's just marketing. And, the funny thing is it's not untrue.
Well, that's the thing. It's not untrue.
It's just not the way that I would put it.
It is not. Yeah.
So that was sort of my way. And also, by the time this happened, I was so much more sympathetic to the ways in which different truths could be expressed. Because, again, that's not untrue. So I felt like, well, it's still true. It's getting expressed in a way that's not necessarily the way that I would express it. But, that's okay.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us. I've really enjoyed this.
Oh, thank you so much. It was an honor to be on the show.
Jessica Lamb Shapiro spoke with Terry last Wednesday. She's the author of Promised Land, My Journey Through America's Self-Help Culture. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.